Chapter 16. Victor Brooks sat in his opulent office, going over the recent numbers. He couldn't wipe the grin off his face. All-out war sure helped his bottom line. He half hoped the war would continue for decades. Keep that one to yourself, he thought. Since President Roosevelt's newly installed War Production Board had allotted money and resources to switch from peacetime production products to wartime production, things had taken off. And with the War Labor Board keeping tabs on any labor issues, Victor's job simplified. All he had to do was keep things running smoothly. The assembly line ran like a finely tuned machine. Engineers and machinists constantly worked to make the process more efficient. Brooks Industries had easily filled, then surpassed, their quota of 30-caliber ammunition in the first 2 months, and would most likely double it by the end of the quarter. They'd already added another product on a much smaller scale, blasting caps. Although a bit more of a delicate operation, it already showed surging profits. Victor pointed to an article in the paper and said, "Did you see this story, Philip?" Philip Bancroft adjusted his spectacles and looked across the table.
"No. What page is it on?"
He gripped his own paper.
"Deep in the editorial business section. It's beautiful. Harry Trask is still talking about sabotage and foul play. The writer says he should stop whining and just get back to work like everyone else. He's being completely ignored."
Bancroft found it and read the article himself.
Finished, he said, "Great stuff. Our timing couldn't have been better. The country wants unity, not this sort of infighting between companies. It makes him look petty.
Perhaps we should offer to buy the land and build our own factory on the ashes of the old."
"That would really bring this thing full circle," Bancroft said with a gleam in his eye.
"We could easily afford it, and profits would surge with more factory floor space," Victor added.
"He'd never sell to us. He hasn't come right out and said it, but he's alluded to us being the culprits. No one's listening, thankfully."
"Yes, perhaps you're right. Something to think about, though."
A knock on the door made Victor remember the scheduled meeting.
"Oh, it's that time already."
He folded the paper and raised his voice.
"Come in, come in."
The managers streamed in and sat around the immense mahogany table. Victor smiled and greeted each of them. He'd known most of them for years. Others were recent additions. They ranged in age from early 20s to late 70s. He let the banter and small talk continue before he cleared his throat loudly and stood.
"Let's get started."
He waited for quiet, then continued.
"First of all, congratulations are in order. We've surpassed our quotas easily. Our processes improve almost daily, and our production has grown steadily. You all deserve a round of applause."
He stood and clapped, and soon everyone joined him, awkwardly at first, then with more vigor. Victor realized with a hint of satisfaction that they still feared him, as though they thought he might lure them into a trap. He let the applause continue, then held up his hand for quiet.
"Now, the new blasting cap section has been operating for 3 weeks now. I understand it's a slower process and a bit more dangerous. That's why it's away from the ammunition production line. I've watched the process, and I'm wondering if there's a way to speed things up."
He leveled his gaze at Miles Burr.
"Mr. Burr, you are in charge of hiring for this section."
Miles confidently stood and answered,
"Yes, sir. That's correct. I see that you have new hires spending a few days watching the process. You also have them learning about the materials they'll be using in a special class. They don't actually start on the assembly line for almost a full week. That seems like a waste of time. Is it because they're women? Do they need the extra training?"
"Sir, as you know, assembling the blasting caps is by far the most dangerous part of the entire process. We decided that a few days of training might help minimize any accidents."
Victor smoothed his silver mustache, then smiled tightly.
"We? I don't recall being included in this decision."
Miles looked abashed. He fidgeted from foot to foot and cleared his throat.
"It was a suggestion from the WPB, sir. I just assumed we'd follow their suggestions."
Victor looked around the room at the other older managers. Philip Bancroft smiled wryly at Miles. Victor said,
Suggestions are just that, Mr. Burr. Suggestions. Anything that slows down production isn't in our best interest, not to mention those of the WPB or the country, for that matter. Do away with the training program. They can learn on the job the same as everyone else.
He grinned.
And the women seem to be fast learners, wouldn't you agree?
Nods all around the room greeted Victor. Miles felt a bit of his confidence return.
You're right, sir. I've been impressed.
Victor chortled.
Well, their minds are like children, I suppose, ready to sponge up anything offered.
He addressed the room now.
Have there been any problems with the men interacting with the women? I don't want any melodramatic cavorting when they should be working.
Oswald Carter, one of the foremen, said,
I put out a notice to the women in my crew that cavorting won't be tolerated.
And the men? Victor asked.
Carter quickly answered, Most of them are married. They don't have time for that sort of thing.
Well, human nature can be hard to overcome sometimes. They're working in close proximity. Keep an eye on things.
Carter said, Yes, of course. Victor directed his gaze at the accountant sitting near the end of the table.
Mr. Calloway, the numbers are astounding. Have you added too many zeros?
An eruption of laughter from around the table made Hammond Calloway blush deeply. He finally spluttered,
Those are the correct numbers, Mr. Brooks,
he added. We've made quite a turnaround since getting the government contract. Victor's eyes softened as he looked around at all the familiar faces. He thought of these men as his children, and he their father.
Keep me informed of any snags you might run into. I think we've got a good handle on things, but you never know, with 75% of the workers now being women.
The men chuckled politely.
Well, now let's get back to work, gentlemen.
The men stood, pushed out their chairs, and made their way to the exits, chit-chatting among themselves. Victor raised his voice.
Mr. Burr, please stay back a moment.
Miles watched the others go, smiling and nodding at the proper people and at the proper time. When everyone had gone except for Mr. Bancroft, Miles said,
What can I do for you, sir?
Victor touched Bancroft's shoulder.
I'm afraid this is a personal matter, Phil.
Bancroft looked surprised, but he pushed his large frame from the leather chair and grumbled his way out of the room without another look. Victor pointed at the chair beside him.
Please, have a seat, Miles.
Miles did so, and Victor stood and paced.
Have you seen my daughter lately?
Miles's face darkened slightly, and Victor wondered about it. But then Miles said,
No, sir. Not for months now. I think the last time was at your dinner party just before those nasty Nips attacked Pearl Harbor. Yes, of course. Not to be brash or vulgar, but I always thought you and Abigail would have ended up together. What happened?
Miles looked relieved at the question, making Victor instantly suspicious that he was hiding something. Miles leaned back in his chair and considered the question.
I really don't know. I've adored her ever since we first played together in your garden. I think she liked me too, but nothing ever came of it, I'm afraid.
Nothing? Miles looked embarrassed, and Victor apologized.
I'm sorry for being so pushy, but I worry about her.
Is she all right?
What do you mean?
I mean, ever since Cooper left, that's her husband, I've hardly seen her at all. She rarely comes by, and when she does, she's soon out the door again. I'd have thought I'd see more of her, not less. I was actually hoping she'd found another boy, truth be told.
And you thought it might be me? I'm flattered, sir. I really am, but no.
He put his finger on his chin and said,
I don't see her as the type who'd be pulled into an infidelity.
Victor remembered Sal saying something similar.
Am I the only one that doesn't know my own daughter? He wondered. Well, if you happen to see her, tell her to pay her mother a visit. She misses her terribly.
Miles smiled his golden boy smile.
I will, sir. I promise. But like I said, I haven't seen her in ages.
Victor watched the cocky young man leave. Again, he had the distinct feeling that Miles had lied. He decided he'd put Sal on the job. Perhaps his sweet Abigail was shacking up with Miles and she'd sworn him to secrecy.
Sal sat in the big Ford sedan, kitty-corner from the front of Abigail's apartment. He'd left the Rolls-Royce in the garage. It would stick out too much in this neighborhood. He'd watched her leave her apartment in the morning, and he'd left the car and followed her on foot. He half expected her to lead him to some new factory job, but instead, she'd entered the corner grocery store. He had waited outside, and a long time later, she finally exited with one small bag of groceries. He thought it odd she'd spent so much time inside and only bought what looked like a few items. He supposed she probably wandered through the store trying to pass the time, or perhaps she'd run into someone she knew and chit-chatted the morning away. He followed her home, and when she entered her apartment again, he slid back into the car and watched and waited. He watched the fourth-floor window, but other than a few occasional wisps as she walked past, he saw nothing unusual. He fought the urge to call on her. It wouldn't be too odd. After all, he'd known her entire life. She'd probably be thrilled to see him. He could say he was in the neighborhood and wanted to see if she needed anything. She was the closest thing he had to a daughter now, and he really wanted to know how she was getting along. He wondered what she did up there all day. She must be bored stiff in that tiny apartment. No one dropped by except an old mailman. He shuffled along and looked like he would fall over at any moment. He didn't buzz her, just dropped mail into the many little mail slots along the outside wall, then went on his way. A few other apartment dwellers came and went, but no one buzzed Abigail's buzzer. The day waned into evening, and darkness followed soon after. He always marveled at how early it got dark in this dreary city during the winter months. It depressed him sometimes, and he wondered how it would be for Abby. Everyone needed a purpose, and right now she must be struggling to find hers. After Clyde left, she didn't have anyone to take care of except herself. Perhaps she'd gotten a dog or a cat, and that occupied her time. But she hadn't left the apartment except that one time. A dog would need the occasional walk in the park. Hours passed. He checked his watch. He didn't want to spend the night out here. Despite turning the engine over occasionally for the heat, he got cold just sitting on his behind. Surely she wouldn't be going out now. The city had a curfew, but it was more of a suggestion than an enforced law. "I've wasted enough time," he thought. He pulled his slouching body upright and put the keys in the ignition. He was about to turn the engine over when he saw a short person dressed in shabby dark clothes approach the apartment entrance. He knew Abby's buzzer was on the far right and beneath the sickly light. He thought this person buzzed her apartment. Sure enough, he saw the curtain above part and Abby looked down on the street. As though she'd been expecting this person, Abby disappeared from view. The main entrance door buzzed and the mystery person entered the building. Just before the door shut, the person looked up and down the street as though checking if they'd been followed. Sal didn't get a good look, but whoever this fellow was, he immediately disliked him. "What the hell's going on?" Sal watched the window intently. Soon shadows passed, and the curtains fluttered slightly. Sal cursed under his breath. He couldn't make himself believe that his sweet Abigail could possibly cheat on her husband, who'd gone off to war so recently. This had to be something else. But what? He opened the car door and hefted his large frame out onto the wet sidewalk. The rain had stopped, but would undoubtedly return. Living in Seattle meant living in the rain. If it wasn't raining at the moment, give it a few minutes. He pulled his overcoat tighter up around his neck and went to the corner. A few people still hustled to wherever they called home, or perhaps on their way to a night shift job. No one took any notice of him as he watched the fourth-story window from across the street. Sal didn't have a plan. Victor wanted him to watch her for a few hours, see how she spent her days. But now here he was at 10:30, wondering what he should do. "I should go up there and bust this guy's chops," he thought bitterly. But Abigail had buzzed him up. She'd invited a strange man to her apartment late at night. He didn't want to believe it, but his Abby had to be up to no good. And such a small man, too. At least pick someone desirable. He suddenly felt ridiculous. Abby was a grown woman. She could make her own mistakes. Who was he to judge? If she wanted to break her wedding vows with a chopped-off runt of a man, so be it. He had no right to interfere. Despite disliking Clyde Cooper, he felt a pang of sorrow for the young man. This would break his heart, or send him into a violent rage. Sal took pride in reading people, and he thought Clyde Cooper could go either way. At first glance, he looked weak and wishy-washy, but he had a fire just beneath those watery blue eyes that disturbed Sal. He didn't know if he'd just be dangerous to himself or to his dearest Abigail. God help anyone that hurt Abigail. Sal clenched and unclenched his fists, thinking about what he'd do in such a scenario. Sal refocused on the task at hand. Victor wanted to know if anything unusual was happening with his daughter, and this certainly qualified. But Sal wondered if he should tell Victor. On the one hand, Victor would be overjoyed that she'd found another man and might move on from Clyde. But on the other, he'd learned that his daughter had broken her wedding vows. Victor liked to pretend those sorts of things didn't bother him. But Sal had known him too long and had been through too much with him to not know the truth. Victor would be secretly heartbroken. He'd never be able to look at his little girl the same way. She'd be forever marred in his eyes. Sal felt that way himself, and he hated it fiercely. He huffed and slid back into the car. He blew warm air into his hands and watched the window. Just a few more minutes. Abby and Trish left the apartment and hurried down the street. Abby kept glancing behind.
"Stop looking so guilty," Trish scolded. "Thought you'd be better at this by now. Just act naturally. We're not doing anything wrong."
"I thought I saw someone back there, that's all."
Trish glanced back, then shrugged and said,
"I don't see anyone. Besides, not everyone follows the curfew rules, and with the war, work goes on all night. It's a big city."
"Big stakes tonight?"
Abby asked casually.
"Yeah, a little different than normal. Charlie said some guys from out of town are showing up, and they're heavy hitters."
"Heavy hitters? You mean they're just rich, right?"
"Nah, this is something different. These guys are real pros."
"Pros? What do you mean? The regulars won't want to play against professionals. They'll get cleaned out."
Trish stepped in front of Abby suddenly and stopped. Abby barely kept herself from colliding. Trish looked up at her and placed a stiff index finger against Abby's upper chest. Her tone dropped dangerously.
"No more questions. Like I said, this is something different."
"A setup," Abby stated flatly. Trish removed her finger from Abby's chest and they continued walking.
"We're going to make a lot of money tonight. That's all you need to think about."
Abby could still feel where Trish's finger had touched her. Despite Trish's small stature, Abby still felt intimidated by her, but she wanted to know more.
"This doesn't seem right."
Trish guffawed.
"Only a rich person would say something like that."
"I'm not rich. Clyde sends money and I do all right at the grocery store."
Trish told her to never mention the words gambling or gambling hall, so they called it the grocery store.
"Your daddy's still rich, though. If the shit ever hit the fan for you, one call is all it would take." "Me? I don't have that option. The shit hits the fan, and I have to sit there and eat it. Don't pretend we're the same, 'cause we ain't."
When Trish got this way, Abby had learned not to push. She was right, of course, but Abby thought Trish used her poverty sob story a little too often. They walked a few more paces in silence. Then Abby asked,
"Won't the regulars complain? What if they refuse to come back because they feel cheated?"
Trish didn't answer right away. Instead, she seethed and gnashed her teeth. They arrived at the grocery store but continued past it, then swerved into the alleyway. Once in the deep shadows, Trish stopped and faced Abby again. She finally said,
"I told you no more questions. Up till now, you've done a swell job, but it's not always going to be nice and easy and perfect. To get ahead, sometimes things have to get ugly. You've got to decide right now. Are you in or out?"
Abby felt like something had changed. She enjoyed the late nights. She didn't particularly enjoy serving drinks, but she enjoyed the excitement. Although she never played, she enjoyed learning the game, too.
She loved watching the gamblers betting loads of money. She loved the strategy and the thrill of the win, but also the heaviness of defeat. She liked the modest amount of cash she left with each night just for serving a few drinks and tidying up the place, but that felt more like a bonus. So far, it had been fair and harmless. Tonight, that would change. But would she be invited back if she turned this down? Probably not. Then what? "I'm in," she stated flatly. Trish slapped her shoulder. "Good. The two pros promised to give Charlie and the rest of us a higher percentage of their winnings. These guys are good, but they're not going to tip their hands too much tonight. They'll play conservatively to keep anyone from getting suspicious. They're here all week, and they assured us they'll have things well in hand by the weekend." Abby nodded and asked, "Should I do anything differently?" "No," Trish answered. She pulled out a cigarette and lit it, lighting up the alleyway momentarily. She didn't offer one to Abby. "Keep taking care of the dealer like you've been doing, and just keep looking pretty." "Ah," Abby's voice changed as though talking to a baby. "You think I look pretty?" she teased. Trisha's voice hardened. "Don't get cute tonight. This is serious business. If this all works out, we'll have a nice payday this weekend. Is that little playboy going to be here?" "Playboy? You mean Miles?" Trish nodded and blew out a long stream of smoke. "Yeah, him."
"I've no idea. He wasn't last week. Why do you ask?"
Trish tossed the cigarette and it hissed into a puddle. "No reason. Just curious." Abby had noticed a slight disappointment in Trish's eyes. She pointed at her and said,
"You've got a thing for him. You've got a crush on him, don't you?"
Up to that point, Abby hadn't been sure about Trish's sexual preferences. It was none of her business. Trish's facade softened a hair.
"He's got a nice tush."
Abby blushed and couldn't contain her laughter.
"Trish," she teased, "you're incorrigible."
Trish gave her a pained look.
"Whatever the hell that means, I'm sure I'm not."
She turned serious again.
"Okay, let's get in there."
Sal followed the pair until they darted into the alleyway next to the grocery store. He ducked into a darkened doorway and waited a few minutes, but they didn't emerge. He stayed on his side of the street and walked briskly while keeping his head down, acting as though he were heading to work or home. As he passed the alleyway, he glanced that way and saw the flash of a lighter lighting a cigarette. In the flare, he could clearly see Abby and the mystery person standing close together. He continued walking until he'd passed the alleyway, then he tucked beneath a dark overhang and watched. 10 minutes passed, and they didn't reemerge. Headlights appeared from down the street, and he sank in closer to the wall. A large vehicle pulled in and stopped in front of the alley. He strained to see if perhaps Abby and her friend were being picked up. Many evil thoughts went through his head, and he scolded himself for even considering them. The back door opened, and a pair of older men wearing long wool coats and top hats stepped out and hustled into the alley. The vehicle sped away quickly, and the pair disappeared into the darkness. From a lifetime of being around rich people, Sal recognized the look instantly. Normally, the driver would have gotten out to open the doors unless they were trying to be inconspicuous. Over the next half hour, Sal watched in stunned fascination as 10 more cars dropped well-to-do men off in front of the alley, then sped away. He even thought he recognized a few of them, but in the darkness he couldn't be sure. The overriding question was, what the hell had Abby gotten herself into? Sal shivered and wondered what his next move should be. The building directly across from him, which shared the alley with a grocery store, was an old condemned building. It had been gutted by fire recently and would have been knocked down by now if not for the war starting and taking all available resources. It didn't look like a place a bunch of rich people would meet for whatever they were meeting for. Neither did the grocery store, but grocery stores usually had large rooms in the back used for stockpiling food. Perhaps they used the space for more than just storing boxes of produce. He remembered how Abby had visited the store for an inordinate amount of time that morning and come out with just one small bag.
Only one way to find out, he muttered to himself. He pushed out of the shadows but quickly pulled back when another vehicle approached. The single headlight and high-pitched engine told him it was a motorcycle. It slowed as it passed Sal. The hairs on the back of Sal's neck stood straight up as he saw that the two riders looked nothing like the other men he'd seen that night. The rider in back held a large case, and they both looked young and tough. Thugs, he thought. The driver pulled in front of the burned-out building, shut off the engine, and parked. They both stepped off, and the man with the case laid it on the motorcycle seat and opened it with two loud clicks. He looked up and down the street. Sal dared not breathe. The thug pulled out a Tommy gun and handed it to his partner before pulling out another. They quickly loaded large, round magazines and primed the deadly weapons. Sal immediately recognized that these men knew their jobs. Professional killers. Cold sweat formed on Sal's forehead. His heartbeat thrummed in his ears. He thought about notifying the police, but the precinct HQ wasn't close. He'd have to deal with this on his own.